is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The amount of knowledge that head coaches have at the higher levels in terms of X's and O's is just unbelievable. And what I learned at that level in terms of how to teach the game and more importantly for us to win games, how to scout our opponent.
Chad O'Donnell is the founder and director of Capital Elite Agency. Chad has been around college basketball since 1993. He spent over 20 years as an assistant college basketball coach at schools throughout the country, including Bryant University, Holy Cross College, the College of Charleston, Robert Morris University, and the University at Albany. During his coaching career and in the years since, Chad has counseled and advised countless coaches on their coaching journey. O'Donnell attended Springfield College in Massachusetts and was fortunate enough to break into coaching as an undergraduate. He was hired in his senior year of college as an assistant at Worcester State College. Over the next 20 years, he moved his way up the coaching ladder to assistant coaching positions at various colleges and finally landed at the University of Albany, where he spent 11 years as the associate head coach. At Albany, the team won 5 America East championships and went to 5 NCAA tournaments. After going to the tournament 3 straight years, 2013, 2014, and 2015, Chad chose to leave coaching to spend more time with his wife and 3 young children. Because of his years in coaching and strong understanding of the business, and with the encouragement of coaches who asked for his help, Chad began Capital Elite Agency 3 years ago to help promote, advise, and prepare coaches to advance in their careers. Capital Elite currently has over 40 clients at all different levels of college basketball. Please consider leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the Hoopheads podcast. 5 stars if you would. Get ready to learn and be prepared with your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Chad O'Donnell from Capital Elite Agency in Albany, New York.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Chad O'Donnell from the Capital Elite Agency. Chad, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me tonight, guys.
Yeah, we're excited to get you on and learn a little bit more about your business and learn a little bit more about what you're doing to help coaches. And we'd like to start, though, by going back to the time when you were a kid and how you got into the game of basketball as a young player.
Yeah, you know, I take pride in being one of the worst players ever to play college, to play high school basketball and get into college basketball. You know, my players when I was coaching used to kind of make fun of me, and I took pride in that. But I grew up in Massachusetts, small little town called Mendon, and, you know, was not a great player. You know, played a couple years high school. You know, people in the area thought I was pretty good, and they would say to me, "Hey, you should go play in college." And I'd say, "Have you ever watched a college game? I can't play at that level." So I actually knew probably around eighth grade that I wanted to get into coaching. So as I was playing in high school, I was already starting my coaching career. So I started coaching in, you know, bitty leagues when I was a sophomore and junior in high school.
What was it that you liked about coaching?
It was really the energy that I saw my high school coach had, and another guy that came and spoke at a camp that I was at, and the passion they had for it and the impact they were making on me. I wanted to have the same impact on players that they had.
So what was the first experience like when you were coaching those bitty leagues? What do you remember about that time in terms of what made it fun for you? And then what were some of the challenges that you faced back in those early years when you were just a young guy coaching other young kids?
Yeah. I mean, when I was in high school coaching young kids, you know, at the time, those kids kind of looked up to me, which is crazy to think, because that never happened again when I was coaching in college. But, you know, I really loved to teach the game, and, you know, that's something that you don't do as much at the college level, and, you know, at the high school level, the impact that you can have and the amount of teaching you do on individual skills is just unbelievable. And I really enjoyed that when I was younger.
Yeah, I can see where that's one of the things that I do here in Cleveland is a lot of my camps that I run are directed towards elementary school kids. And it's something that I really have a passion for, and I really love working with that age, because to your point, you get an opportunity to really work with those young kids on their fundamentals and teach the game in a way that's different than you do when you're a high school coach or a college coach, where there's obviously more strategy and more team building and that kind of thing, as opposed to just strictly, hey, here's how you shoot a left-handed layup, or let's get enthusiastic about doing a defensive slide drill or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I think that I can totally understand where you were coming from with, you know, that passion that you had for working with young kids. When you got to college and you had an opportunity then, while you were still at Springfield College where you went, mm-hmm. you had an opportunity to start your coaching career while you were still there. Can you talk a little bit about how that opportunity arose and then what exactly that opportunity was?
Yeah. So I, you know, as I was saying, I got into coaching in high school. And so when I was a freshman in high school, I was an assistant back at my high school. I would drive back. And then when I was a sophomore, I was like the middle school coach. And then while I was doing all that, I would go work camps in the summer. So, and this is when college camps were kind of a big thing. So I would work UMass camp. I'd work Wisconsin camp. I'd go to Tennessee and work Tennessee camp, Seton Hall, camps throughout the country. And so I, going into my senior year of college, I worked that summer before about 14 straight weeks of camp and really got to know a lot of good college coaches, John Calipari, you know, and a lot of different guys, Kevin O'Neill. And because of that, you know, now I had a lot of confidence that I could kind of maybe go after, you know, my first college job. So I reached out to about 5 or 6 colleges within the area of Springfield, and all 5 of them offered me positions on their staff and interviews. So I went and interviewed at a couple different colleges. These are Division III schools, and they were all part-time assistant spots. But for a young guy like myself, it was a great opportunity. So the job I ended up taking was being an assistant and the head JV coach at a school called Worcester State College, which is a Division III school in Massachusetts. And my first head coach that I worked under was Tom Moore. And Tom is now the associate head coach at UConn. And so I worked under him for a year, and I commuted every day, an hour each way, just so I could kind of go work for him from Springfield.
What do you remember about that first job in terms of the biggest challenges that you faced day in and day out as a brand new assistant and being young and kind of getting into the program?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I knew a lot because I had studied the game in terms of how the college game worked. But I can still remember, and I tell people this all the time when they start a new job, you know, the first few weeks I can remember sitting in the office and not having a lot to do. And I was like, am I doing the right thing? What am I doing here? And maybe I chose the wrong career, and maybe I should just walk into coach's office and quit. You're like, this is, you know, and I tell people that now. I'm like, you take a job and you're going to have second thoughts that, you know, maybe this isn't for you. And what I found was that, you know, I just had to immerse myself in it. And I'll never forget the paper in the area of the Boston Globe. And this is back, and I'm an old man now, but this is back in 1993. The Boston Globe came out each winter with the list of all the high schools and their schedules for the whole season. And I can remember cutting that out, and I said to myself, every single night that we don't have a game or a practice that I have to be at, I'm going to go to a game. And so every single night I went recruiting during the winter. And
joys of being single, Chad.
It was, as I say, you know, being being an assistant is a young single man's game. And I loved it because I was still a senior in college, and, you know, I wasn't a party guy. So I liked being on the road and having a car. I'd go to a game every night. I'd highlight the game I was going to go to, and I'd go to it and get to know as many people as I could. And obviously recruited a lot of kids to come to Worcester State. But more importantly, I kind of developed a reputation as somebody who kind of worked hard, and I got to meet so many different people that it helped me for the rest of my career.
Yeah, I can see that completely. How did you go about balancing your academics there while you're still in school and trying to finish up with your coaching duties? How did you balance those two things out?
Yeah, it worked out great for me because I was a phys ed major, and you know, not everybody chuckles. You know, I was a phys ed major. I was a smart guy, but I chose phys ed because it was the closest thing to coaching. So yeah. I did that, and my senior year was the first semester. Your senior year, you do student teaching. So I was student teaching at a high school right near Springfield College the whole day from about, 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. And then right after that, I'd jump in my car, drive an hour to Worcester, coach, go to practice, and then I'd go to a game near Boston and then drive all the way back to Springfield at night and then repeat it the next day. And then the second semester, I worked out a deal with all of my professors because I had classes second semester that I had to finish up. And I basically told them what I was doing. And most of them agreed to let me kind of take the class without showing up. Like I would just do the work and turn it in. And you know, it was a big help for me.
So you were the originator of the online classes then? Is that what you're saying?
I was the originator of the online class. I can tell you two great stories. One, about 5 years ago, I got a book in the mail. It was The History of Volleyball. And I was like, what is this? And it was written by a guy who was the volleyball coach at Springfield College. And so I got it, get in the mail. I open it up. First thing it says in the acknowledgments is that I'd like to thank Chad O'Donnell for all the work he did on the history of volleyball. And I'm racking my brain trying to think what I did. And I finally remembered my senior year, because I couldn't take this class, the teacher of the class was the volleyball coach. And he said, I want you to write a paper for me on the history of volleyball. And so
contributing to his book. You were a ghostwriter and you didn't
exactly.
even know it. That's hilarious.
He's like, so I wrote a paper on the history of volleyball. 20 years later, I get a book in the mail and it says, I could have never written this book without the help of Chad O'Donnell. And
that's
I'm like,
fantastic.
This is crazy. And then the second thing, and this is another phys ed thing, is you had to take gymnastics class your senior year in which you would actually try to do these gymnastics things like the balance beam, the pommel horse, all that stuff.
Good luck with all that, Chad.
Exactly. And so if you go to the class every day in the semester, I'm sure it works out that you can learn to do it. Well, I never went because the guy was like, hey, just show up the last day for the final and I'll make sure you get it done. So I can remember showing up the last day and he's like, yeah, I need you to do this. And I was like, yeah, there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. And so he got like two of his gymnastics players to kind of help me and basically hold my legs up so I could do a handstand.
And he was like, good thing there was no cell phone video in those days.
Oh my God. It was awesome. But anyways, I learned to balance kind of learned to buy my way out of doing some of these classes so that I could continue to coach and get into it right away.
That's very cool that you were that focused on, wanting to get into coaching because that you were able to balance those two things, because I'm sure that would have been a challenge for anybody. And yet you were able to pull that off. I want to jump back to what you said about working those 14 straight weeks of summer camp and talk a little bit about why that experience was so invaluable, because we've talked to several coaches who have mentioned the summer camp circuit as being a place where they were able to develop the relationships that really got them off to a head start in their career. So talk a little bit about what you feel you benefited from working all that time at those summer camps at, across the country at these different colleges.
Yeah. As you said, it's all about the relationships and, coaching is all about the relationships. Everybody's like, oh, I want to get this job. I want to get that job. And you're only going to get it half the time if you know somebody. And for me, because I got to work all these camps, I had developed all these relationships over 3 years in college. And, they're not my references now, but back when I was going to be a senior at Springfield, John Calipari was like, hey, put me down as a reference. And, John Robick, who's the assistant at Kentucky now for John Calipari, was my reference. And he actually made a call for me to to Tom Moore at Worcester State so that, you know, he offered me the position. So the amount of people that you meet when you work at colleges is awesome. And it's kind of too bad because nowadays with AAU and all these elite camps, the college camps have kind of died up a little bit and they're not as attractive as they used to be. But I still say to people all the time, to younger coaches, you know, the best thing you can do is work camps in the summer and work as many as you can in different areas so you can meet as many different people as you can in this business.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that camp circuit because I think back to my time and I worked at quite a few back in the day. And what I found to be valuable was there's a lot of not just time on the court where it's the formal camp, but it's those informal times where you're sitting around the dorm at night or, you know, you're going out after the kids go to bed, whatever the case might be. And that's really the time when you can get a chance to get to know somebody and really build that relationship. And to your point, you never know what that relationship is potentially going to lead to down the road in terms of other jobs and opportunities that may present themselves.
Yeah, I can remember being at UMass camp. And this was when John Calipari was the head coach of UMass and making the runs to the NCAAs and all that stuff. And I can remember at night, John Calipari back then wasn't like he is now. He wasn't, you know, a total superstar. He would still kind of hang out with all the coaches.
Still kind of hang out with all the coaches at night.
And I can remember he would have what he called like his chalk talk. And we were in a classroom and I was only just finished my sophomore year of college. And I can remember I'm in there with all these guys that are a lot older than me. And he's like, okay, everybody get up and go over one play they want to show. And I can remember he threw me the chalk and I was sweating bullets because I'm a sophomore in college. I had no idea what to play. and I can still remember, you know, they were throwing out these terms, you know, like America's action, you know, and staggered screens. And at the time, you know, I was still kind of learning the lingo. And I can remember walking out of there going, I have a lot to learn.
Yeah, I could see that completely. It's one of those things that one of the best memory that I have of college camp is I worked at Ohio State's camp when I was maybe probably about the same age as you were. I was maybe a sophomore in college.
Yeah.
And I had gone to Ohio State's camp when I was younger and had been in some other overnight camps. And of course, as a kid, you have no idea kind of what goes on behind the scenes with the camp, with the coaches. And my experience was not quite as formal as yours, where it was focused on basketball. Mine was focused on coaches getting together to tell jokes.
So
there was a big meeting at the varsity club, which was a bar in Columbus. And, you know, all the coaches are there and, you know, the kids are all sleeping at the time. And, you know, some poor saps got stuck back in the dorms supervising, but for whatever reason, I was able to go to this, this informal meeting. And I just remember all these coaches had to take turns telling jokes and everybody, the new people all had to get up and tell a joke. And I remember being mortified having to tell a joke, let alone having to, you know, get up and write a play. But it's just interesting. Those were the times where you got to build relationships. You got to talk to people. You got to see them kind of in a different light, in a different element, and really get to build the opportunity to network and get to know people. And eventually those are the types of things. And those are the people that can help you out along the road, especially as a young coach.
Right. You know, it was different for me than some people, because as I said, I was an awful player. I'm a short, fat, bald guy. And back then I was a short, fat and losing hair guy. And, you know, you were a great player. You know, you went on and played in college and were playing at the time, whereas everybody knew I wasn't playing in college. So when they would have the council games at night, I wasn't playing in those. And, you know, I can remember I went to one camp and worked a camp. And because of kind of, you know, I wasn't a player and all that stuff, the coach was like, you know, you'll be like an assistant on one of the teams at the camp. And I was like, this guy doesn't even think I'm good enough to coach, you know. And I can remember that there was like Tuesday of the camp and the guy that I was the assistant for couldn't make the morning session. So I had to run like the stations. And so I ran the stations And I'll never forget, and it gave me great confidence, is after I taught the stations, the head coach, who's actually still coaching, came up to me and he apologized. He goes, I just want to apologize to you. He goes, I kind of thought that you had no clue because you don't play in college. He goes, but you know what you're doing, so I'm going to give you your own team, and you'll be all set. So, but you know, I was a guy that, as I said, I was not a player. You know, I took the hard way to kind of get into coaching.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer at Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that, you know, you talk to people that go at it from both directions. I know guys that were not players beyond high school or were marginal high school players that turned out to be very, very good coaches. And then sometimes you see guys who are very, very good players, but don't necessarily have the ability to be a good coach. And we talked to, actually, I think it back to a conversation we had with Casey Korn, who he's a coach at UW Oshkosh Division III, yep, who just made the Final Four. And yeah, he said something that he was a much better, as a kid, he was a much better baseball player. Like, it came naturally to him. Yep. And so when he tried to coach baseball, he said, I wasn't a very good baseball coach because I couldn't figure out why the kids couldn't get it.
Right.
Because everything came so easy to me. And whereas with basketball, I was a good basketball player, but it just didn't, I had to work at it. So it didn't come as naturally to me. And so therefore, when I went to teach basketball and coach basketball, I had to really go through my process and think about how am I going to teach this skill to my players. And he said, as a result, he felt like he was a much, much better basketball coach than he was a baseball coach, even though he was more naturally talented as a baseball player. And I think you see that. And so I think that speaks to your story very strongly, that you don't have to be a great player, have to have been a player at a certain level, if you're willing to put in the time and do the things that you did, which obviously set you apart from most guys, because most people are not doing the things that you did when you were in college to be able to get your coaching career off to a start.
Right.
Most people just aren't willing to do that. And so by putting in that time, you were able to, I don't want to say make up for, but you were able to overcome that stigma of not having been necessarily a great player, but somebody who could teach the game. And I think what that head coach said to you at the end of you running the stations was validation for, you know, probably what you knew back in the, you know, deep down in the back of your head, you knew you'd put in the time, you knew you could do it, but I think there's always doubts no matter what level you get to. Yeah. I think we all always have doubts.
Yep. I always find, and maybe it was just me, but as a non player in college, I always felt like I had to prove myself to the players that I really knew the game, more so than guys who played the game. I just think it's, you know, the guys who played the game and were, you know, all stars and all league players, you know, the players that they coached, they knew that and they, you know, look up to them a little bit, whereas nobody was looking up to me. They were like, you know, does this guy know what he's talking about? So I had to prove that I knew what I was talking about a little more, I think.
Do you think that went away as you went further along in your coaching career? Like, by the time you were 10 years in, do you feel like that went away, both from in your own head and also from in the eyes of your players, who probably at that point didn't have any idea or didn't really care whether you had played or not?
I think it went away about a week after I got to meet my players. But in the very beginning, I always felt like I had to prove myself. Even when I you know, got up to Division One and was in my third or fourth Division One coaching job, I always felt like, you know, you really need to prove that you know the game and know how to teach the game to these guys, because they don't view you sometimes as an elite player. And that's just kind of how I felt. Maybe a lot of guys don't, but for me, it was always kind of in the back of my mind.
Yeah, and I'll bet that kept you on edge and kept you sharp from a standpoint of you always thought that, hey, I've got to be on top of my craft, because if I'm not, then the way that these guys might look at me might cause me to lose their respect, or might not, they might be able to get my message across to them and be able to coach them as effectively as I would want to.
Right. You know, and how did you feel having played in college? You must have felt very confident going in to teach the game, I would think.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's always doubts. I mean, I think you have, I think each of us as a coach struggle with maybe different aspects of what you want to do as a coach. We talked to a local high school coach here in Cleveland right before we talked to you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I said is, in my very first coaching job, I was coaching a high school JV team. Yep. And I was doing that by myself. And one of the things that I felt was completely overwhelmed as one person trying to run a practice and manage a team and coach during a game and figure out how to sub and when to call timeouts. And just on the practice floor, what I found to be the most difficult is I would just see so many mistakes in 5 minutes of action. I could have stopped play 500 times in that 5 minutes with all these different errors that the kids were making.
Right.
So I found it to be overwhelming. How do I manage those errors and those mistakes? And how do I manage my coaching so that I know what's important, what's not important? What do I let go? What do I need to stop and address? And that was one of the things that I found to be the most challenging. So I think I was confident in my ability to teach the game. It just was more a matter of being confident of, am I doing the right thing as a coach? The coaching technique part of it, not so much the knowledge of the game, but more how do I coach? And that was something that was definitely a learning process for me as I went along. I wasn't very good at it right out of the gate, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about your journey through the coaching ranks. Obviously, you slowly make your way through a couple different jobs, a couple different levels. Can you just talk a little bit about, just in general, the journey and maybe some of the highlights as you went through your coaching career?
Yeah, you know, so I stayed at Worcester State for 2 years. We went to one NCAA, and it was a great experience for me. And I can remember finishing up my second year there thinking, you know what, I think I'm ready for the next challenge. And back to kind of the story I told about going out and recruiting every night, because of that, I had gotten to know a lot of college coaches. So I reached out to a coach at Division II school right down the road called Bryant College, which is now a Division I school, and said, hey, I'd love to talk to you about joining your staff. And so he hired me basically the next day and went down, worked for him part time for a year. And I always tell this to my clients now. He was the best coach I ever worked for in terms of helping me market myself. And what I mean by that is I worked my ass off for him, but I never asked him to do anything for me. And like a lot of coaches, and he would on his own make calls for me to other colleges and say, hey, you need to hire this guy, or you need to interview this guy, Chad. He's really good. And I can remember three different times I walked into the office and he's like, hey, tomorrow you have an interview at Central Connecticut for the assistant spot. And I'm like, I didn't even know there was a spot open. And then I didn't get it, of course. And 3 weeks later, he's like, yeah, I have an interview set up for you tomorrow at Stonehill for a full-time Division II spot. And I was like, great, didn't get it. So finally, I was only there for like 7 months. And I was working summer camp, and he's like, yeah, tomorrow you're going up to Holy Cross and you're going to interview for their assistant spot. And he is the epitome of a guy who really wanted to help his staff. And I'll never forget what he did for me. And And, you know, because of that, I was able to get right to Division One now as a 22, 23-year-old. I was on the road as an assistant at Holy Cross. I stayed there for 3 years. We got fired, which happens to a lot of coaches if you stay in the business long enough. And, you know, the head coach, we just didn't win enough games. And so from there, I went to the University of New Hampshire for a year and back to being young and single. I could go wherever I wanted and did that for a year. And then I went out to Robert Morris University in Pittsburgh for a year and down to the College of Charleston for a year. And then finally was able to get a real good assistant spot up at the University at Albany, where I eventually became the associate head coach. And I stayed there for 11 years. And the reason I stayed there for 11 years is I met my wife and had three kids. And once you become, you know, kind of attached, it becomes a lot harder to move. And but, I, you know, I had a great career, you know, at all those stops coaching.
Yeah, stability becomes a lot more important once you have a family. It becomes a lot more challenging to do some of the things that you described from earlier in your career. I want to go back to something that you said about your very first job. And you talked about how hard you worked and how much that your head coach helped you. And so I want to take the question kind of in two directions. One, in your mind, what makes a good assistant coach? And then what makes a good head coach from a standpoint of the relationship between the head coach and the assistant? What are you looking for as a head coach and an assistant? And as an assistant, what are you looking for in a head coach? Because obviously you had a chance to work at lots of different places with lots of different people. So kind of speak to your experience about what makes a good assistant, what makes a good head coach.
Yeah. You know, I think the first thing for an assistant is obviously you got to be loyal. And everybody overuses that term, but you really do. You have to be loyal. The one thing I hate more than anything is if I meet an assistant that I don't know very well, and he goes and badmouths his head coach to me. You know, I'm like, the first thing you need to be as an assistant is loyal. You need to understand who you work for and that your job, number two, is to make his job easier. That's the most important thing you need to do as an assistant, is find ways to make your head coach's job easier. And if that means that you have to work the guys out in the morning and get shots up with them, or that means you have to fold the laundry because he doesn't have to do it at some programs, you know, your job is to always make his job easier. And then the second thing is find what your head coach is weak at and become strong at those things, because that's going to make your program better. So as an assistant, those are the things I look for, is make sure you're loyal, make sure you find ways to make his job easier, make sure you try to, you know, fill the gaps of the things that he's bad at. And then as a head coach, you know, I think your job as a head coach is to provide feedback to your assistant and move them. And too often head coaches only want to, And I hate to use this term, but they only want to use their assistants to get the best out of them, but they don't give them feedback and they don't try to move them. And what I mean by that is I've worked for some coaches, and if I didn't ask them, they would never tell me how I was doing. And, you know, I think as a coach, you need to provide feedback to your assistant and tell him, you know, if you're doing something good, let him know. If you're doing something bad, let him know. If you're not ever going to kind of make it there as like his top assistant, so you're the third assistant, let him know that. You know, too often, like, head coaches will let a guy sit in a certain assistant spot on his staff and just use him there, knowing they're never going to move him up. And my thing as a head coach, you need to be honest with your staff. And then the second thing is your job is to make them head coaches eventually. Some of the best coaches in the game now, like Tom Izzo and Rick Pitino, and those guys, you know, took pride in their staff getting head coaching jobs. And so they would go out and try to get them jobs, kind of like the coach I was talking about earlier. Whereas a lot of coaches in the game forget about that. Like, because they get their job and they're so busy doing their job, they forget that their job is to help move and get those assistant jobs, because that's why you're an assistant. Nobody wants to be an assistant forever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's one of the things that sometimes the general public forgets about, and that, you know, it's easy, I think, as a head coach to get stuck in the idea that it's all about you and your program and my wins and losses and what can the assistant do for me. But I think the very best coaches are ones that can, you know, you get to the top and you reach back and you pull somebody up with you. And that's, I think, a key for anybody who's a head coach, is to be able to reach back and help your assistant to get on to that next job, or to help them grow even in their own position. It just seems like if you're not providing feedback to somebody, how do I know whether or not I'm getting better? And I think no matter what your job is, if you went about your job all day and nobody ever told you, hey, you're doing a good job, or hey, you're terrible at this, how would you, it wouldn't be a very satisfying place to work, because you'd have no idea whether or not your contributions are making a difference to the overall success of your company or your team or whatever the case might be. So I think that that's something that, you know, it's, I think we're better at it today probably than we were a while ago, because I think there's more focus on that and people kind of understand that that's how the business works.
Yep.
But I still think there's probably guys out there that don't do a good job of that. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. I think I'm amazed, you know, and I have, you know, clients that are assistants and, you know, and run the gamut from assistants to head coach. And I'm amazed at how many assistants don't meet with their head coach at the end of the year to go over what they're doing good, what they're doing bad, what they need to get better at, and how they can move in this business. They just continue to, you know, the season will end and, you know, they don't have that end of the year meeting, and they just kind of get out in the road and start recruiting again, building towards the next year. So it happens a lot more than I thought it would. It didn't happen for me because I always required it of the coach I worked for. I would go in there and close the door and say, hey, what am I doing good? What am I doing bad? You know, what do I need to get better at? But too many assistants don't want to have that, you know, closed door conversation with their boss, because they're afraid sometimes of what the answer might be.
Do you think you're unusual in that case? Like, I mean, do you think that you were sort of an anomaly of somebody who went in and sought out feedback, or do you think that most people do that or don't do it?
I think most just don't. They don't think of it. I think they just think, you know, he's telling me I'm doing fine, you know, during the season, he hasn't complained at all. And, you know, I feel like I'm bringing in good players. And, you know, so as an assistant, you can kind of get caught up in the job, and, you know, you might be doing an awesome job, but your head coach isn't letting you know you're doing an awesome job enough, or he isn't letting you know the things that you're bad at. You know, there are some awesome college coaches out there that are assistants that are unbelievable X and O guys, and their coaches love them for that. But they don't tell them, hey, if you want to really get, you know, improve in this business, you got to get better at recruiting, or vice versa. There might be assistants that are the best recruiters in the world, and that, you know, everybody's patting on the back saying you're doing a great job. But then that head coach isn't telling them that they need to learn the game a little more, or to learn to teach the game, or learn the X and O's. I think it is a lot more prevalent than I thought it would be, you know, having talked to a lot of college coaches now.
Yeah, I could see that, where if you just think about people in a regular job outside of coaching, where, hey, as long as I got my job and nobody's coming to talk to me, things must be going pretty good, and I don't want to rock the boat and go in there and find out that I'm not doing a good job. So maybe it's just better to hang with the status quo and just continue to go about my business. But at the same time, I think one of the things that has probably happened in the last 5 to 10 years for sure is there's been this shift in the thought of having, you know, a growth mindset, where I want to get better, and in order for me to get better, I have to get that feedback so that I know where I can grow and where I can improve. And so I think as that becomes more prevalent, just in, you know, you read a lot about it, there's lots of books out there on that type of topic, where people are understanding now that you get a lot more out of life, you get a lot more out of your job, whatever it is, if you solicit feedback, so you can then take that feedback and try to go and improve your performance. And so I'm guessing, just from the outside, that you're probably seeing more people seeking out feedback than maybe would have 5 or 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, people are becoming smarter and more educated as to how they, you know, have to improve in the business world or in college coaching or high school coaching or anything.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
If you look at your time, let's just take your time as a Division I assistant. What do you think you improved on the most over the course of your Division I college coaching experience?
Yeah, I obviously for me it was X's and O's. I mean, I can remember I would scout games when I was at Division III and II levels, and even my first Division I job, and thinking I knew what the other team was doing and stuff. And the amount of knowledge that head coaches have at the higher levels in terms of X's and O's is just unbelievable. And what I learned at that level in terms of how to teach the game and more importantly for us to win games, how to scout our opponent. When I first got into Division I, I kind of thought of myself as a guy who knew how to recruit. And I think I always was pretty decent at that. But my X and O's knowledge and how to actually, you know, scout a team went way up at the Division I level just because of the amount of film and the amount of tape and the amount of, stuff that you're watching on your opponent. Whereas at the lower levels, you don't have time and you don't have the staff that you're able to spend that much time on it.
So did you find that you learned that from just you sitting with the film, or was that you sitting with your head coach, your fellow assistant coaches, having discussions? How do you feel like you learned those things in terms of the scouting and in terms of the X's and O's?
Yeah, great, great question. I think on a good staff, you learn that from your head coach. And so I can remember I worked for Mark Schmidt, who's now the head coach at St. Bonaventure. When we were at Robert Morris, and we would sit together as a staff and watch our upcoming opponent. And so the knowledge I would gain from what Mark could see, and, you know, his knowledge of X and O's is off the charts. So I would walk out of there and be like, I didn't see that at all. And, you know, then when I moved from there, I went and worked at the College of Charleston. I worked for Tom Herrion, who's now he went and became the head coach after Charleston, at the head coach at Marshall, and now he's an assistant at South Florida. And he would have us sit down as a staff, watch every tape together of our upcoming opponent. And not only would he do that, he would stop it and say, Chad, what would you run here against this team? Give me two plays. And so he'd make you be on your feet the whole time. And, you know, I learned so much working for him in that setup in terms of how to decipher the opponent, how to attack the opponent, how to learn the game, how to stop an opponent, because we would watch it as a staff together. And then when I went to Albany, we would do the same thing. You know, every night when we would play a team, when the game ended, we would stay in the office until 1, 2 in the morning as a staff and watch the game we just played and break it down as a staff. And you would learn so much about the game just being with, you know, your head coach. So that's the thing that you really learn, you know, at the Division I level, is how much knowledge some of these head coaches have.
Do you think that's typical in terms of the entire staff breaking down, whether it's your own game or whether the opponent's game, or do you think there's a lot of places where, I guess in my mind, a lot of times I envision the assistant coaches spending the time breaking down the film and then bringing their observations to the head coach. How would you say, which one happens more or less? Or
yeah, I think it used to be like you said. I think it used to be more the assistant. And, you know, the head coach would kind of like get the report and watch one or two games. But now, because of the pressures on college basketball coaches, it's become more of a staff thing. And I think maybe that's something I brought with me, too, is like, you know, I would make a lot of recommendations to my head coach, and I'd say, hey, Mark did this when I was with him at Robert Morris. So, you know, and that, or we did it at Charleston, why don't we do it at Albany? And so, you know, I think more and more coaches are doing it that way, but I don't think it was the norm, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I do think, you know, when I first got into the business, most, and even now, some people are just doing it on their own, hoping they find the right stuff. And then the head coach will watch one or two games. And I did have one or two jobs like that, where I would just watch the game on my own and give the scouting report to the head coach. And he'd say, hey, looks good enough to me. Let's go try to win. And and we didn't win. We didn't win. So, you know,
maybe the system should have changed, right?
It should have changed. But I didn't know that back then what I knew now.
Right.
You know, and it's back to kind of what you learn as you're in the business longer and longer. I think back to when I was at Holy Cross back in 1996, and I'm like, I was an awful assistant coach. I was awful. I was awful, you know, for my head coach. You know, I'm sure he probably at the time thought I was pretty good, and most other people thought I was okay. But like, what I was like in 1999 or 96 compared to what I was in 2015 when I got out of the game was night and day. And it's kind of funny how as time passes and with each season, how much you do learn.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that, that each time you get an experience, you know, you put it in your pocket and you're able to go and grow from it and then apply it in the next situation. I wanted to ask you about, you were probably just getting in on the sort of the beginning of the huddle crossover video breakdown type services when you were playing. So how much of a difference did that make for you? And I don't know where those services were in 2015.
Yeah.
But obviously some of the guys that you're representing now have the opportunity to have that type of film breakdown done. How much of a difference has that made in a coach's life at the college level?
It's unbelievable. And it kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the scouting. When I was at Holy Cross, the only way you could get a film then was you would get it FedEx to you from the opponent, from like a common opponent the next day. So you wouldn't get the film till maybe a day or two after. And so you were usually scouting them based on their games 4 or 5 games ago, because you couldn't get their game right before in time and usually get it broken down. So when I first got in the business, it was all VHS tape in the mail. And I can remember getting tapes that were broken and you couldn't watch it.
Trying to hit the button to get it to stop where it was supposed to.
It was the worst. And, you know, even the edits we would make for our players, you know, would have that snow screen between nice. Each clip. And then when, you know, when I was at Albany, you know, in the 2000s, you know, obviously DVDs came out and that was made it a little easier, but you still had to wait for the game to get, you know, shipped to you FedEx wise. But then when it started to go, like you said, you know, Huddle and Synergy and that stuff, you know, that's where the game has really changed. And it's changed for the better, but it's also made it a little easier for assistants than it ever used to be. Because back when I first started, you had to watch the whole film to kind of get an idea of what a team was doing or how they wanted to score. Now you can just on Huddle or Synergy watch their offensive possessions only. And or watch their defensive possessions or watch one player, how they score. So the amount of knowledge that you can gather in a short amount of time is just unbelievable now to kind of how it used to be. And the advantage you can gain from that for the coaches that use it is incredible. So, you know, I always think about the time we wasted, you know, when I was an assistant, we didn't have a director of ops back then. And you would have to fill out all these FedEx slips after the game to get it to the other schools and hope that they would get it to you. You know, it was crazy. You know, I'll tell you a story that, you know, a little off topic. But when I first started coaching was in 1994. And, how old are you? You know, I'm
49, so I graduated from college in 92. So we're right in the same era there.
I was 8 at the time, just so you know.
Coach Jason's a little younger.
Jason,
so.
I'm going to ask you this, okay? Mike, don't give him the answer.
I won't give him the answer.
So, Jason, we had a game when I was at Worcester State at Eastern Connecticut. Now, I had to go scout the game of our next opponent live at a school called UMass Dartmouth. So in total, those schools were 4 hours apart. So I'm at one school. Our team is at the other school playing. The game ends. How do you think I found out if we won?
That's a good question. I would say, I don't know. You got the newspaper the next day? I don't know. That would be my guess.
Well, if I wanted to wait to the next day, that would have been how
I would say you went to a payphone and called someone.
Who would I call? Because they were on the road too. There were no cell phones. So you couldn't call anybody. So
you called the opposing team's school or whatever. I don't know.
Maybe if you could have reached someone. What I did, and I can remember this, is I drove back to Worcester State to the school, and they had a longer trip. So I waited 2 hours in the office until the bus pulled up, and I can remember walking right up to the bus going, did we win? And to think about, you know, how much technology has changed, that now I can be at that game watching the other team play, my other team play live on my phone, is just unbelievable.
It's crazy.
It goes back to the amount of knowledge that you can get in a short amount of time. Crazy. You know, so. You know, how the game changed with technology, you know, not to sound like, you know, the oldest guy in the world, but like it is unbelievable how much it has changed to help the profession and help coaches kind of become better.
Yeah. I mean, I think about my experience in college and think about the times that we as players were privy to watch film. Like I was never given a film to watch myself. Like I never remember taking a VHS tape back to my apartment to watch film, never. And even sitting with the coaching staff, like I said earlier, I remember like coaches trying to get the button to, you know, rewind, let me see that play again. Then you rewind, you're like 3 minutes past where you want, oh, fast forward. And then before you know it, you forget about that play and you're on to watching something else. And just how imprecise the process was and how ineffective it was in terms of really passing along any genuine knowledge that me as a player, as I'm sitting there in the locker room, I'm like, well, maybe they'll show one of my highlights that I, you know, they'll show that basket that I want to see that I scored. You know, I want to see what that looked like. And there was very little value to me in terms of prepping for my next opponent or really getting me ready to play. It was more just me getting a chance to watch the game more than anything else. And nowadays, obviously everything's digital and you can send it to players' phones and you can break down and give them anything that you want. And it's just so simplified. And to your point, the amount of time that it has to save for coaches has just got to be unbelievable.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you know, now players, you know, like you were watching a VHS tape, you know, in the locker room, maybe the day before a game. Now players are getting the clips sent to them the night before on their phone. Yep. And they can actually watch it on their phone in slow motion or watch it, you know, over and over if they want.
Yeah, it's got to be tremendously valuable. I mean, to some degree, I wonder if, at least from a player standpoint, I would definitely not say from a coaching standpoint, but sometimes from a player standpoint, you wonder if there's a little bit of overload, especially on a college player. It's one thing for a professional player to have that level of, you know, ability to look at film, but sometimes I wonder from a college standpoint how much benefit there is to, I think there could be overkill, I guess, is my point with how much you're sharing with the players. Cause a lot of times, at least in my experience, when I was coaching, a lot of times my kids didn't even know what they were supposed to do, let alone worried about what, you know, worried about what the opponent was supposed to do.
Yeah. I can remember when I was, you know, even at Albany when in 2005, you know, we would show an edit to our players and it'd be 15 minutes long of, you know, the opponent we were playing. And by the time, you know, it was 2012, 2013, we had cut it down so much because we realized our guys weren't picking it up.
Yeah, they were tuned out.
Yeah, they were tuned out. So we cut it down to like 6 minutes. And it became like a game for us as a staff to see how short you could get the edit and still have as much in there for the players to pick up.
Yeah, I could totally see that. That makes total sense to me from a playing standpoint. I just think that, you know, a lot of times you'd see that scouting report and you'd look at it and you just gloss over, because
right.
so much of it is just, you're so focused on what you need to do and what your assignments and your things that you're supposed to be doing, that it's hard to necessarily spend a lot of time and worry about what your opponent's going to do. Let's jump forward now to your decision to leave coaching mm-hmm. and kind of get towards how you ended up starting Capital Elite.
Yeah. So I as I said, you know, being an assistant is a single man's game, you know, especially at the Division I level with time demands. So when I was, you know, at Albany in, you know, 2006, I got married and, you know, I didn't have any kids then. So it was workable for a couple of years. And then I had my first kid and it got a little harder, and my second kid. And then by 2012, I had my third child. And, you know, now it was like, I can remember, 2013, 2014, we would finish practice at 8 p.m. and I'd be racing home as fast as I could. Almost, I'm amazed I didn't get in a car accident, just trying to get to see my kids before they went to bed. And then the next morning we'd have practice or individual workouts early in the morning. And it was like, I wouldn't see my kids. And finally, it was just, you know, in 2015, I was fortunate. We went to three straight NCAAs. We won the American East title for three consecutive years. And I was the associate head coach and kind of living the dream, but not totally happy with the balance in my life. And, you know, my wife grew up in this area. And so it became harder and harder for me to even look at other jobs because she doesn't ever want to move. And so when I factored all those things together, it became time that, hey, why don't I try to kind of try something else? So in 2015, I got out, not knowing exactly what I was going to do. And maybe about 4 months kind of away from coaching, a couple coaches that I, you know, kind of, you know, knew in the business called me up and they were like, hey, you know, can you help me with this or help me with that? And the reason being, when I was coaching, is I would help a lot of coaches in the business because I worked my way up as a young guy and had done everything. So I knew how to do a real good resume. I knew how to prepare for an interview. I knew how to, you know, prepare for a phone interview. And so when I got out of the business, I didn't even start Capital Elite. I really just started helping my friends. And then finally, Brent Wilson, who's a head coach at a junior college called SUNY Sullivan in this area, said, hey, you're really good at helping coaches. Why don't you start your own agency? And so I did that. And basically thinking, oh, it would be something fun to do on the side before I started my next career. And as I put up a Twitter page, nowadays with social media, kind of word gets out. Finally, Todd McGinnis, who was the head coach at Hartwick at the time, called me and said, hey, you know, I know I don't know you at all, but I, you know, can you kind of explain what you might be able to do for me? And so I explained it. And we can get into kind of what I do later, but, you know, he ended up getting a better job out of that. He got Case Western, where he is now as the head coach. And from there, it's kind of grown exponentially. So now I'm up to basically almost 50 clients, and I'm a full agency. You know, I have some clients that are Division I assistants and Division II head coaches that are trying to get, you know, that Division I head coaching job, and I'm an agent for them. And then I have Division II, III assistants that I'm just trying to teach how to move up in this business and improve their interview skills. And for those guys, I'm more a consultant.
Talk a little bit about what the services are that you provide that coaches come to you that they're looking for when they give you a call.
Yeah, so the biggest thing I do and is I prepare them to advance, and that's kind of my tagline. And so, like, I'll take a client, and I won't give you his name, but, you know, he came in to me, you know, called me up. I redid his resume for him because what you find is basketball coaches are great at coaching, but awful at putting together resumes. So I've gotten resumes that are 8 pages in size 8 font that you can't even read. I'm like, this guy is an awesome coach, but you would never know it because his resume is unreadable.
This resume is going to be in the trash can as soon as it arrives, right?
It's unbelievable. I'm like, dude, if I can't read this, who can read it? So I obviously that's the first step I do is I fix their resume so that they can go out and apply for a job. And then the next thing I do, especially for coaches that are at the lower levels, like Division III assistants and even some Division III head coaches, I prepare them for their interview, their phone interview, and their interview. So I took a client last year who was a Division III assistant, and he had 15 phone interviews for head coaching jobs because he was at a school that was very attractive, had a very attractive resume, but every phone interview he would bomb. So he had never gotten past the phone interview stage 15 times.
Wow.
So I took him and I worked with him on the phone constantly in terms of how he needed to answer questions. And we worked on that back and forth and for about 3 or 4 days in a row. And finally, you know, about a month after, you know, we partnered together, he was able to get another phone interview and he blew it out of the water, got a on-campus interview and got a head coaching job, all because he learned how to improve his interview skills.
So what does that look like? So when you say somebody's going to improve their interview skills, what does that look like in your mind? How do you go about, what are some of the things that you try to share with coaches of, hey, this is how you should approach this particular interview?
Yeah. So like tonight, I one of my clients reached out to me. He has a phone interview on Monday next week for a head coaching job. He's a head coach at one school and he's going for a head coach at another school, which is almost a double in pay. And so tonight I sent him a list of 15 questions that they could potentially ask him on the phone interview. And the reason I know what a lot of people are asking is because every time one of my clients does a phone interview, they call me right after with every question they were asked. So
got your question database.
I have a database of all the questions and how often they were asked. And so now I pulled together for each job a list of questions based on what kind of job it is. And so me and this client will spend the next 3 or 4 days going over his answers to all those questions. And you might think that, you know, and I'll start with a simple question, but like, you know, what are your biggest strengths? You'd be surprised at how many people bomb that question. And what I mean by bomb that question is they'll come back and say, well, you know, my biggest strengths is I'm hardworking, I'm loyal, and I'm easy to get along with. Well, why should I hire you? You know what I mean? So they didn't sell me on any reason that they should be the next head coach at a school, you know? And so what I do is we craft answers based on their experiences together so that they have a much more cohesive answer to each question. So then when he has his phone interview next Monday, every question that comes at him, he's already kind of prepared for and can kind of knock it out of the water and has a much better chance of getting on campus. And then when he gets on campus, now I'll spend another 3 or 4 days before he goes to campus so that when he goes to campus, he knows exactly how to kind of position himself for the job and kind of, you know, how to answer each question. So most of my clients, when they call me after their on-campus interview, they'll call me and say, hey, every question they asked, we had gone over. So for me, it was really easy to answer every question. I didn't get nervous. I didn't stumble in my words. And I felt like I knew what I was talking about.
Do you think it's a level of detail thing and also like something that's tailored to the school? Like I would imagine, depending upon, again, obviously the level, but also the type of college that it is, whether it's a high academic school or what the you know, what the culture of the school is, do you find that by helping them to prepare for those things, I would think that that would really help get somebody prepared.
Yeah, it does. And it all comes back to my experience when I was a coach. When I would get interviews, I didn't have anybody. And so I would go to my buddy, and usually my buddy was another coach. And in all reality, he didn't care what my answers were, because what he was really hoping in the back of his mind was, hey, if Chad gets this job, maybe Chad can get me his job. So, you know, they're not even listening to what you're saying. Right. Well, then when I got older, I was asking my wife, hey, how does this sound? She doesn't know the first thing about basketball. So, like, you know, I had nobody to go to. And so what I found is, you know, it's just like in coaching. Like, we spend so much time as coaches learning how to teach. You know, right now, Mike, you'll learn how to teach a screen, you know, how to defend a ball screen, you know, five different ways, or how to, you know, go and take a, you know, layup. You know, you'll work on that relentlessly. But how much time do we as coaches work on interview skills and work on becoming a better potential coach for jobs? And so I always say that, you know, there are some great coaches at lower levels, and the reason they're stuck at those lower levels is because they don't have the interview skills developed yet. And whereas they might be the best coaches in the world, and then there are coaches that, to be honest with you, aren't the best coaches in the world, but they're just awesome at interviewing, and they're at the highest level, you know. And I've seen it. I've seen guys that are at Division I schools, and you know, they look like they really know the game and all that stuff, but when you really kind of watch them, you realize that they got the job because they were really good at marketing themselves and interview skills and stuff like that. So it's what I try to do is take guys that are good coaches and make them increase their chances of being able to get a job.
You're still a coach.
I'm still a coach, but in a totally different way. I'm coaching them now how to get their next job. And then, you know, obviously, you know, as I've kind of progressed in this business, now I'm working with guys who are Division I assistants and Division II head coaches, and even some Division III head coaches. So, you know, I had a coach today that had an interview for a Division I job. And for that guy, he doesn't need as much prep work because he's pretty polished, but we still went over about five or six questions that I knew they were going to ask and how he would have to answer it so that he didn't stumble, you know, for a real good Division I job.
What's the most challenging part of what you do day in and day out?
I think that the most challenging thing for me is just the amount of time I spend, you know, on the phone, you know, with clients, especially this time of year. Because, you know, I might have five guys that are trying to get in for all these different jobs, and then I have three other guys that actually have phone interviews, and then I have two guys that have interviews on campus. So I'm at different stages with each of them, preparing them for their next step. So just the amount of time I'm on the phone now is really challenging for me.
What's the most satisfying part of what you do?
Obviously, the most satisfying is when that guy calls me and tells me he got the job. There is no better feeling. And it kind of goes back to when I was recruiting, and you would get the call from that recruit saying, hey, coach, I want to come play for you, you know, at the University at Albany or whatever. And you would be giddy for like the next, you know, day and a half, because you felt like you got the next, you know, Michael Jordan. Little did you realize that the kid, you know, didn't end up panning out for you, and you wasted all that time recruiting. But that's another story. But the best feeling for me is when a guy calls me and says, hey, I blew it out of the water on that phone interview, and I feel really confident I'm going to get to campus. And then they do. And then they call me after they get on campus, and they're like, it was awesome. I knew everything I needed to do. And then 2 days, 3 days later, they call me and they're like, hey, I got the job, you know? And so the amount of impact I have on some people now is just really satisfying to see that, you know, they have jobs that, you know, they might not have had if it wasn't for you know, the prep work we did together and the time we spent together kind of getting them prepared.
I'm sure they're all super appreciative. What does it look like? Are you spending the majority of your time during those transition periods with the coaches where they are looking for a job? Let's say that somebody's your client, they've been at a job for a year or two. What's the relationship like between you and them at that point? Yep. What does that look like?
Yeah. So now I use more my coaching hat and my, you know, psychological hat, I guess. So like for a guy that gets a job, you know, he's not looking to move now for 2-3 years, maybe, you know, when he's trying to build that program. So now what I do is I spend a lot of time just kind of helping them as they progress where they are. So I had a coach call me Sunday and he's like, "Hey, can I talk?" You know, and I thought he was going to be wanting to talk about a job. And instead we spent an hour talking about an issue he was having with one of his players and how he was going to handle it and whether he should involve his athletic director. And, you know, so I become kind of an outside counselor for those guys, and a trusted counselor, because they know that, you know, it's going to stay between us. And, you know, they're going to get advice that they might not be able to get from their assistants, and they're not going to have to bring it to their AD yet. They're going to be able to bounce it off me as to kind of how they have to, you know, attack a situation. Or they might call me and say, "Hey, I'm going to meet with my athletic director tomorrow. What are some questions I should ask him?" Or, you know, "I'm going to meet with, you know, this person." Or, "Hey, I'm trying to finish my recruiting class. Give me some tips on how I can maybe get this last kid. What can I do that you did that's a little different?" You know, so that goes back to the 20 plus years I spent into coaching, kind of just providing valuable feedback and almost being like an assistant to the head coach at times.
Yeah, it's got to be tremendously valuable for those guys to be able to have somebody who, whether you want to describe yourself as a mentor, agent, however you want to look at it, to be able to have somebody to bounce those kinds of questions and those kinds of ideas off of, to your point where it's not somebody who's on the staff who's that close to it, but you're kind of an objective eye in the sky. I can see where the value in that for somebody who, we all know that coaching, whether it's at the college level or high school level, whatever, there's stress that's involved in that. And so when you have somebody that you can reach out to when you have a difficult situation, I'm sure that's tremendously valuable. And then for you, I would think, just listening to you talk, I would think that you would find it to be so interesting just to talk to these different guys about sort of the things that come up in their day-to-day job and situations that they're presented with. Because obviously you've had a tremendous amount of experience and we're in a lot of programs with a lot of different coaches. And yet there's still things that I think you know, you hear about the inner workings of other programs. I know that's one of the things that I've always found to be, I guess, something that I always wondered about was when I was a player, I wonder what it was like playing, instead of playing at Kent State, what was it like to play at Ohio University, or what was it like to play at North Carolina during that time? You know, kind of what was going on behind the scenes. And so as a coach, you kind of wonder, well, what's it like to coach at such and such university? And so you're kind of getting that window into what these guys are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. So for you, I think you would find that interesting.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, so, you know, for me, you know, and I find it really helpful, and they find it helpful. And I always tell them, like, "I'm not your friend." So, you know, because of that, I can tell them, "Hey, you were wrong," or "I think you were
right."
I think that is an awful answer. I think that what you did there, you should never do again. And you should go apologize to that person right away. And if you think about it, as a head coach, most of these guys, or a lot of these guys, even assistants too, they don't have that person that can tell them, "Hey, you're wrong." Because, you know, they don't, a head coach doesn't want to show that weakness to anybody. You know, so I'm on the outside and I can tell them on the phone, nobody else is going to know I told them. And I can say, "Hey, you know, this is what you should do. You were wrong. You should go apologize to this person, fix it. Or, hey, you did that thing exactly right. And I think you're doing the exact right thing." And then, you know, the other thing that I find nowadays is how much coaching has changed in the last 10 years. And you know, I don't know what, if it's, you know, political correctness or what it is, but the teaching and coaching going on now is so much different than it used to be. And I'd like to get your thoughts, but like, I can remember when I was first in coaching, you know, just how you would kind of reprimand or yell at a player that you could never do now. And back to when, Mike, when you were playing, you can probably tell some great stories about.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
No question.
And nowadays, the coaches now are actually better. I think they're better than they were back then because they have to be able to teach the game and make corrections and attack problems without losing their temper and without, you know, doing things that, you know, coaches would try to do, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Chairs across the floor.
Yeah. I look at it as like, I feel like, at least in my college experience, I look at it from a standpoint of there was a lot of what appeared from a player perspective to be psychological warfare.
Right.
Between the coaching staff and the players.
Yep.
And that took on lots of different forms. And yet I think that if the things that kind of went on behind the scenes when I was playing were to go on today, that those things would be much more likely to come out to the light of day as opposed right. to being kept behind closed doors. It's just with social media and with phones yeah. and with all the things that players and coaches, to be honest, have access to, I think it's a lot harder to, I don't want to say hide because that's the wrong way to put it, but I think it's a lot harder to keep things behind closed doors today
totally.
Than it was 15 or 20 years ago for sure, just because of the prevalence of phones and social media. And so I would guess that, and again, I haven't been in a college locker room in a long time, but I would guess that coaches today are much more focused on what we talked about earlier, which is building those relationships, building the process, and getting buy-in in different ways besides that psychological warfare that, you know, I kind of described.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, it goes back to, I can remember I used to say to people, like, some coaches you play for cause you love them, and some coaches you play for cause you kind of either hate them or fear them. Nowadays, that it's almost all gone to the first. Like, if you don't love your coach, you know, you're in trouble, because the coaches that you fear or the coaches that you hate aren't in the business anymore. It's really hard to be in the business nowadays if you're a coach like that. You have to be a more of a, you know, I guess what you might call a player's coach, but somebody that, you know, is more about family and caring. And to be honest with you, and I'm sure you've seen it with kids now, and I look at my kids are harder on themselves than we would be when we were younger, because they look at their image a lot more now because, hey, I didn't get 50 likes or I didn't get 100 retweets or, you know, I have no friends on Facebook or, you know, these things are important to kids now. Whereas when we were playing, we would just go out and play.
You right. know? Or just the comparisons. Like if I'm on social media today and I'm a 10th grade high school basketball player, I'm not comparing myself now to the kids in my neighborhood or the kids at the,
right.
you know, the next city. I'm comparing myself to everybody who I'm watching on Twitter, and I'm seeing their highlight films and all this stuff. And I think that's something that definitely plays a factor in how kids perceive themselves today versus how it was when you and I were kids.
Right. Yeah. When I was a kid, all I knew were the good players in the league that I played in. That's all I knew. Now you can spend 10 minutes on YouTube or somewhere and find out the top 10 eighth graders in the country. And it's amazing how much you can kind of learn that is kind of bad sometimes, because now you're focused on the wrong thing. You're not focused on you. You're focused on you compared to everybody else. And so the pressure's on kids, you know, people talk about it. And back when I first had kids, I didn't think it would be as big a deal, but the pressures on kids now is much more than when I remember my childhood.
Yeah, that's for sure. And there's so much, you know, I know this is kind of a little bit different topic, but parents definitely feel peer pressure from other parents. And then I think they put that peer pressure on their kids. to succeed. And I've had this conversation with lots of people about my own kids and kind of the way that I've approached their situation with basketball. And none of my kids, they all play, but none of them love the game the same way that I did. And so I find, as a father and as a coach and as somebody who has some knowledge of kind of what the system looks like and what the right things are to do, you know, I've learned to provide my kids with opportunities, but not force them to do things. And yet at the same time, I'll be completely honest that it's not always easy, even though I know it's the right thing to do. It's sometimes difficult to not say, I'm going to drag you to, you know, this workout, or we're going to go and do this, whether you want to do it or not.
Right.
And I know that's not the right thing to do. And yet I struggle with it. So I can only imagine what parents who haven't navigated the system, the pressures that they face. And, you know, they hear about little Johnny next door from, you know, his dad about how he's playing here and doing this and going to this trainer and playing on this many teams. And, you know, they look around and think, boy, if I'm not doing that, whew, you know, my kid's falling behind.
Oh, exactly. And now you have moms that are on Facebook and seeing their friends and, you know, their friend's son is doing this. So, oh, maybe I should be doing that. You know what I mean? Whereas it used to be, you know, you would kind of do your own thing that you enjoy doing without kind of looking at what other people did as much. Now, because you see what other people are doing on social media so much, you too often compare yourself to them, and that becomes a pressure on families.
Yeah, it really does. And it's something that people struggle with. I think when you really sit down and have a conversation with parents of youth athletes, and I don't want to limit it just to basketball, I think it cuts across any sport. People feel pressure, and they feel the time crunch. And just to your point of why you got out of coaching and wanting to spend more time with your family and getting a chance to be able to see your kids. And I totally related. I want to jump back to something you said earlier, because I could totally relate to it, how you were talking about, you know, you get done with a workout and you'd be racing home, you know, to get home after practice. And I can remember my last year or two of high school coaching, you know, practice would be going on and I'd be looking at the clock, and, you know, I wouldn't know what time it was going to end. And I'd find myself like secretly waiting, rooting for it. You know, boy, right. I hope we're done at 5. I hope he doesn't want to extend this practice till, you know, till 5:30. Cause I knew if I could get in the car at 5 and get home, my wife would be happier versus if I was 5:30, you know, and all those things. And then it takes away from your experience, obviously, the coach, and you're not there committed in the same way that it was, again, when I was young and single and had all kinds of time. Like, we'd practice my first year or two. I used to laugh because we had the same coaching staff for 13 years as a high school staff. I was the varsity assistant. We had the same JV coach and the same varsity coach. And we started, I was like 25. Our JV coach was maybe 22 and our head coach was probably 30. And we would literally have like a 3-hour practice in high school. And then we would sit around the coach's office for an hour and a half, 2 hours after that. And, you know, I had nowhere to be. I didn't care. Yep. And it was great. But then once you have a family and you have kids, now practice would end, and 30 seconds later, as soon as the last kid's out the door, you know, I'm out the door too. And it's just a different approach once you have a family.
It's hard. And I can remember my last few years, like my first few years, a player would like come up after the practice and we'd watch film. And my last few years was like, hey, come back tomorrow morning. You know what I mean? I got to get out of here.
Right.
Exactly. And that's when you realize, like, that, you know, being an assistant is really a young man's game. I think as a head coach, you can balance it a little more because
you have control over the schedule.
You have total control of your schedule. As an assistant, you have no control. And so, like, you know, I would be like, hey, looking at practice to see how late it would go to, so I could text my wife and be like, hey, you know what? I'm not going to be home for dinner. And, you know, it was like so stressful at times.
I can totally relate.
And I knew it was time for me to get out of coaching in 2015. I can remember we had just gotten back from playing at the University of New Hampshire. It was 3 a.m. and I had to go food shopping for the family, because my wife had 3 kids. We had 3 kids, so she couldn't take 3 kids food shopping. So I was going food shopping at 4:30 a.m. at this supermarket, thinking to myself, and I'm in a suit and tie because we had just had a game, And I'm like, what is going on in my life that it's 4:30 in the morning and I'm doing the supermarket shopping? So I knew right then it was becoming a little too hard to balance for me.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. So I think where you're at now is probably a better family situation for sure. I want to be respectful of your time, Chad, and start to wrap things up. So if you wouldn't mind sharing out how people can reach out to you, learn more about what you guys are doing there at Capital Elite, and then if there's anything else that we didn't touch on that you want to share with the audience, you can go ahead and do that now, and then we'll wrap things up.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, anybody who wants to reach out to me, I love talking to coaches, young coaches, you know, older coaches, anything. So if you ever want to reach out to me, go to my website and it has all my contact information. So it's CapitalEliteAgency.com. I'm also on Twitter at @CapElite Agency. And then, hey, if you want to call me, it's 518-331-6965.
Fantastic. Chad, we can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's been a blast. We really enjoyed getting to know more about what you do. And hopefully the people out there in the audience enjoy doing that too. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.